NGOs who would like to see the government spend more energy on environmental refugees or climate change refugees and inundation from the sea and those sort of things. I believe that's Western agenda. That's not Bangladesh's agenda.
Nishat says the world has underestimated how resilient his country is in the face of natural disasters of the sort its people have faced for millennia.
So having said that, am I not worried about sea level rise? Answer is yes and no. I'm not worried against inundation of the land and people migrating because their houses would be underwater.
I knew Nishat believes his country will develop the necessary infrastructure to protect its people from the slow but inexorable rise of the sea.
But I'm worried because in the coastal area, the frequency of this cyclonic event would increase, like the cyclone Sidr.
Bangladesh is used to large-scale natural disasters and cyclones, but the people here are still in shock at this sudden violence.
On November 15, 2007, Cyclone Sidr struck Bangladesh with 140-mile-per-hour winds and 20-foot waves. After the storm had passed, 3,000 to 5,000 people were dead, and 10 times that were injured.
The closer that we've got to the coast, the more damage that we've seen, like here, this whole row of shops, which has just been swept.
Half a million houses were destroyed. Because of global warming, storms of this magnitude are expected not only to become more frequent, but also to penetrate farther inland as the sea level rises. And for this, Bangladesh is not prepared, says Ainun Nishat.
I had the privilege of talking to Senator John Kerry in Bali. And after some discussion, Senator Kerry pointed me and said, if I could give one thing to you from the United States to address your climate change concern, what would you ask for? I said, I would ask for long-term meteorological forecast. We need some satellite information. We need more modeling experience. This is an advanced technology. We need that.
But up to now, protecting Bangladesh's land along the rivers and coasts has centered around a very old technology, dikes.
This is river. Right side is the river. And this is old land.
A heavy-set man dressed in wrinkle-free pants and a spotless polo shirt is driving me through the outskirts of Khulna, the third-largest city in Bangladesh. He's Shafiqul Islam, director of a small college and founder of the Pani, or Water, Committee, a grassroots farmers' rights group. From our car, Islam gesticulates toward a man-made pond, rice seedlings poking up from its surface, a dirt dike holding the brown water captive.
You need to understand, this is the river and that is the farmland. Now you can see that the river is full of sediment.
Islam says this area, like the Sundarbans, was once flooded at high tide each day. Farmers built dikes to create freshwater paddies for rice and fish farming, but their flimsy embankments often gave way in storms and seasonal river floods. In the 1960s, at the behest of the government, international aid organizations began helping to construct a system of sturdier dikes, strong enough to serve as roads.
Because in our country, we always think that the Western countries' manners are very good, and they are very knowledgeable. They know everything. But we are very poor countries. We don't have vast knowledge. We don't have good engineers here, and therefore we have to invite engineers from outside.
But that attitude led in time to disaster. As the modern dikes withheld sediment year-round, river bottoms rose. And without new infusions of silt, paddies sank as the old soil compacted. Rivers and dikes began to tower over the farmlands like elevated highways. In a matter of decades, once productive plots stagnated and became infertile. People had no food. Shafiqul Islam and others proposed cutting dikes to let silty water flow in and out for a few years to replenish the depleted paddies as it once had. Water officials and engineers rebuffed their suggestion. So in 1997, a band of frustrated farmers decided to defy the government and test the idea right here at the crest of a dike. Shafiqul Islam.
There were many police and government officials present while we cut the channel, but thousands and thousands of people were there to help us, and we did it.
As an estimated 20,000 farmers watched, a team of strong men hacked a hole in the dike with shovels.
A huge amount of water went to the wetland side with silt. After the high tide is in full, the water remains stagnant for about 15 or 20 minutes, and at this time the silt is deposited in the wetland.
The plan to save the paddies outside the city of Khulna worked. In 3 years, they had collected a 4-foot deposit of new silt. The dikes were repaired, and rice and fish flourish here once again. Islam says the same method, if more widely adopted, will be crucial in shoring up Bangladesh's delta against the slow advance of the sea. While there may be no permanent solution, experts agree it will take a concerted effort incorporating many such ideas and billions upon billions of dollars for Bangladesh to adapt to the new conditions being brought by climate change. Another approach is the cultivation of rice and other crops genetically engineered to withstand saltier water. One Bangladeshi scientist wants to expand the use of traditional floating vegetable gardens made of packed water hyacinths to help feed this fast-growing nation. And a local architect has received funding from the United Nations Environment Program to build a fleet of school boats to keep Bangladesh's education system afloat. Just as global warming is increasing at an ever faster rate, so will the population of Bangladesh rise to an estimated 300 million by mid-century. The difficulty of growing enough food here increases as global warming creates conditions favorable to more frequent and more severe storms, and rising sea level compounds the flooding caused by storm surges. For example, in 2007, storms and flooding wiped out 6% of Bangladesh's rice harvest. Atiq Rahman, director of the Bangladesh Center for Advanced Studies, an environmental think tank, says such disasters have wide-ranging consequences.
The political implication, the social implication of food security is big here. You know, the food prices control whether government stays or government goes.
Rahman says his country's most important priority should be securing its food supply, and he wants the rest of the world to understand what's at stake for developing nations like his.
Because, as you know, more than half of Bangladesh is really poor, abject poverty. And among the poor in the total budget, 60 to 70% is food, while for the rich American, it's 3 to 10%.
We'll be right back. This is Making Contact. You've been listening to a special excerpt from the documentary Heat of the Moment, produced by Daniel Grossman and originally broadcast by WBUR Boston in collaboration with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. To find out more about the Heat of the Moment series, visit our website at radioproject.org. That's also where you can download past shows and make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Up next, Making Contact's Jasmine Lopez interviews Daniel Grossman about his work.
Earlier in the show, we heard one part of the documentary Heat of the Moment. This part was about sea level rise in India. Daniel reported from France, South America, Mongolia, Southern Africa, Bangladesh, and India, exploring how global warming is influencing the lives of people around the world. Daniel, thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Daniel, you reported Heat of the Moment quite a while ago, but your reporting is focused on climate change. Could you tell us more about your work?
About 15 years ago, I discovered that climate change was a big problem, and I decided I wanted to devote my career to reporting on it, its impacts, its causes and consequences. And I've been traveling to various parts of the world ever since to learn about it.
How did you first begin your work on Heat of the Moment?
Prior to Heat of the Moment, I did another project that I called Meltdown about ice around the world. And I decided that I needed to focus more on the human impacts of climate change. I wanted to show how climate change was affecting people right now because I hoped that people could who are skeptical that this is a problem might be able to empathize with other people who are already feeling the effects of climate change. And so that was my initial thought.
How did you come across the story in India and those communities?
Well, I was looking. I looked for. I wanted to have a diversity of climate change impacts. So I reported on a big heat wave in Europe because one of the things that climate change does is it causes greater incidence of extreme weather events. And I wanted to do something related to sea level rise. And there's been a lot of talk about Bangladesh, and the Bangladesh is a country with a very large population, about 150 million people, and in a relatively small area, and it's very low lying. So I was thinking about Bangladesh, but as I did my research, I discovered that this one area right at the mouth of the Ganges and Brahmaputra rivers that is a huge wetland had some important impacts that I could see now, and so I immediately realized this is going to be pretty interesting here to see what's going on with these mangrove forests, the largest unbroken mangrove forest in the world. And as it turned out, I ended up reporting half of the time in India in this mangrove forest called the Sundarbans, and half of my reporting was in Bangladesh itself.
So what did you find? Can you take us there to this community? Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, I traveled for 2 or 3 weeks in both India and in Bangladesh. The park, the Sundarbans Park, the Sundarbans is a archipelago of islands, very low-lying islands, mangrove forest and former mangrove forest, and you have to travel by boat to many of the places because they're islands. Some of it is a national park where there are some amazing wildlife, a lot of unusual birds, and of course the Bengal tiger, which is the national animal of India. And so we tried to see as many different aspects of changes that are occurring and impacts of climate change in the Sundarbans. So we spent some time in the park where the tigers are protected, although they don't always stay in the park. And we visited a number of islands that have experienced a lot of erosion and where people have lost land, lost their farms and become impoverished because of that. And we saw the embankments, they're called. They're mud dikes that hold back the water on some of these islands, and talk to people who live behind these embankments. And it's a very beautiful area. A lot of people go to the Sundarbans to experience wildlife. A lot of birders go there because there are many, many unusual birds there. Then, of course, there's the Bengal tiger there. There's the barking deer. There are crocodiles. So it's quite a beautiful place.
Do you have any idea how those communities are doing now?
The situation hasn't gotten any better since I was reporting there. The main issue is that sea level is rising, and that these places are very low lying, and so they're already very susceptible to storm damage. For instance, there are cyclones there, which is the Indian Ocean equivalent of hurricanes, and so if sea level starts even a little bit higher, there's just that much more damage when a storm occurs. Also, it appears that storms are getting more intense. So the communities are becoming more and more vulnerable every year. When I was there, I talked to a number of people who had lost land because of storm damage. These islands are actually below sea level. In their natural state, they were mangrove forests, which were covered in water part of every day. The tide would come in and they would be covered in water, and then the tide would go out and they weren't covered in water anymore, and there was a forest growing there, a low forest. People built mud dams, which they call embankments, around the perimeters of these islands. So the islands ended up looking kind of like bowls. And as you're riding around, going from island to island, you'll see these big walls, and you can see a tree poking up over the wall, or you can see a house, the roof of a house above the wall, and you land at the embankment, then you climb up above it, and then you see that there's all this dry land on the other side. So they've essentially drained an area that normally was wet a good portion of every day. And so they're just extremely vulnerable. And so, and since they're made of mud, of course, they breach rather easily in a storm. And so I met people traveling around who had lost land because during a storm there might have been a small breach in an embankment, and then because of erosion, water flowing in would make the hole bigger, and then the land inside would start eroding, and they could some people had lost large portions of their farms and could no longer had a livelihood as a farmer. So I think that's still happening. These islands are slowly eroding away and will continue to do so as sea level rises, and also as appears to be the case as storms grow in intensity.
Thanks again for talking with us.
I really appreciate your inviting me to talk to you.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening to Daniel Grossman's documentary, Heat of the Moment. Daniel's report was produced at and originally broadcast by WBUR Boston in collaboration with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. To find out more about Heat of the Moment, or to learn about Daniel's latest book, visit our website at radioproject.org. That's also where you can download past shows and make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Quan Booth, Andrew Stelzer, Laura Flynn, George Lavender, and Rochelle Robinson. I'm Jasmine Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
And without a doubt, you're tuned to Pop Defect Radio, the soundtrack of the resistance. My name is Skidmark Bob. Check out popdefectradio.blogspot.com to download the show and more information. This week, a tribute to one of my favorite punk rock bands of all time. That's right, Bad Religion. Some of their oldest to their latest releases. We're going to start off with one of their earliest releases off of their album, How Could Hell Be Any Worse, 1982. This track's called Fuck Armageddon. This is Hell. Keep it locked. Stay tuned for a special hour edition of Bad Religion on Pop Defect Radio, the soundtrack of the resistance.
and welcome to the late edition of Bathrobes Piers Broadsides. Today is April 16th, 2015. I'll be with you for another hour and 45 minutes, and we'll be covering the Santa Cruz scene as it's looked to me in the last few days, and perhaps as it's looked to you. You can call in at 427-3772, and we'll chat. The show concerns itself with civil rights in Santa Cruz and the voices of folks outside.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mere into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
And that was Pins and Needles. That's our opening song, Sing Me a Song of Social Significance. Good evening. I'm Robert Norris, and this is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. It's a show that concerns itself with, well, raising issues around civil liberties that are happening here in our community and that have to do mostly with folks who are poor, near poor, or... And sometimes has to do with activists, so that's another issue. But that's my general area of coverage, and so that's what I will be covering. And in the course of this, as regular listeners know, I tend to wander here and there, often to the same places in search of news stories, and often I get what appears to be the same old stories, not the most encouraging or hopeful stories often, and nothing that often is always entertaining. I hope it's educational, and it's certainly real, and we're talking about how folks are treated who are outside and those who are interested in restoring civil rights for them. And this isn't the project of just a few people in a few cities. It's across the country, but I try to focus on Santa Cruz and what's happening here. And the most recent issue that's come up with the group I work with, HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, is First Alarm security guards. First Alarm is one of the companies that the city has employed to move people along and essentially provide a visible police presence of a cheaper kind downtown, at the library, at City Hall, in the parks, along the levee, and I guess even in the beachfront areas, though that the boardwalk there, the boardwalk company has its own sort of security thugs, as I like to call them. And you might ask, well, what's wrong with security? What's wrong with having some people there to make sure that people feel more secure? If why not? Well, the answer is that they are designed, of course, to make some people feel secure by running off other people who they see as a sort of a, either a potential security threat or, more than that, an aesthetic eyesore. That's the problem. And it takes numerous forms. It usually takes the form of these individuals just, quote, enforcing the law. The laws, of course, that were created by City Council for the criminalization of the poor who are in positions at the merchants or conservative residents or conservative bureaucrats in positions of power don't want them to be. And in this case, it's about 99% of the sidewalk if you attempt, for example, to sit down at something other than a sidewalk cafe or one of the fewer benches that can be found, some of the downtown and almost none in other parts of the city. They've been removed, as I understand it, from the Beach Street area as well, according to reports we got in the last show or the show before last. So the security guards have been a focus, mainly because we've gotten reports for us at the Homeless United group, because we've heard that at the library, one particular guard, a tall guy called John, has been stalking about, intimidating people, both with his manner and with specific instructions that he's directing people, giving to people to direct them. You can't be here unless you do this, unless you do that. Pick up your stuff, move it, put it together. No, don't close your eyes in the library. You're being evicted. You can't be on the grass here. Don't sit on the stairway here. You're blocking things. When none of these things are a real matter of public security, safety, or even convenience, but simply an expression of this particular person's sense of what he has the power to do and what is appropriate for him to do. Maybe he's being told to do this. I don't know. I don't have the inner track on this stuff. And I think the appearances we've done at the library, we've been there twice, serving coffee and other edibles, usually in the mornings around 9:30 for a couple days, when we acquire accounts as to what folks are going through. We encourage people to deter the city's sleeping ban ticket torture machine, because that really is what it is, however genteelly you want to put it. Waking people up in the middle of the night who have no place to go and giving them citations that require them to appear in court or face a loss of credit, face a loss of a driver's license, face the garnishment of their wages, and giving them no, as I said, no legal place to go at all, is a way of simply putting on the pressure to get them to disappear, which means leave town or be so deeply hidden that you're invisible from us. And that, of course, has been a process that's been going on for 20, 30, maybe even longer in terms of years here in Santa Cruz City area and in the broader county area as well. But particularly what's been happening recently, we've gotten reports from outside the Cafe Bergalisi, which is on Cedar Street, a block away from Pacific in downtown Santa Cruz. There's been a repeated series of police actions against people on the sidewalks, where admittedly young people do cluster and socialize and talk, and in talking to some of the regulars, yeah, you get the occasional drug dealing activity going on there. You get the occasional folks sitting down, and it's illegal to sit within 14 feet of a building, even on that side street. On the Paragalisi side of the street, I examined the maps today of the downtown zone area. It's in the central business district, which has, in which criminalization of sitting has become almost universal, except in some very limited areas where you're not 14 feet from a building, 14 feet from a kiosk, 14 feet from an intersection, 14 feet from a sidewalk cafe, 14 feet from a telephone, 14 feet from a change-making machine, and the list goes on. 14 feet from a drinking fountain, 14 feet from a trash can. That takes up almost all the space. If you add to that the space of the sidewalk cafes, and then that taken up by the illegal commercial signs, the freestanding signs from the businesses. And yeah, I was surprised to find that they were illegal, but that's what the government authorities told me. And I said, why don't you remove them? And they just sort of said, well, no one complains. And indeed, that may be a project for Huff, which is to go to the merchants and say, look, either you acknowledge that a human being has at least as much right as one of your commercial signs to sit down and rest on the sidewalk, or we will start filing formal complaints complete with video of your abuses and demand that these signs be removed and that fines be imposed for these kinds of winked at commercial violations, which are not really in and of themselves directly injurious to homeless people, but show a double standard that is so blatant and so obvious that it really should not be tolerated in this community. I mean, I don't like the general principle, well, you're going to have to harass everybody if you harass me. That is to say that a broader policy of harassment is not necessarily better. But if you are going to be focusing simply on homeless people, one way to stop that focusing is to also turn the pitiless light of publicity on the segment that you're not harassing, but that is doing the same thing, taking up the same space, taking up more space, in fact, and for private commercial gain, which is the merchants downtown, and persuade them to say, look, we have to start being fairer about this. We have to understand people have needs, that these sidewalks are not simply private walkways to our businesses. They're public sidewalks, and that's really the issue. So at the Cafe Pergolisi tomorrow, Huff is planning to serve coffee, maybe brownies, and some other munchables, depending on how creative our cooks are. Pat Colby has been very diligent in this stuff. She cooks good stuff. She'll be doing that tomorrow. We're going to be there in front of the Pergolisi, providing free coffee and essentially monitoring what the police are doing there and trying to remind people of what their rights are in Santa Cruz as far as, and remind the police too, and remind the community that the sidewalks are for all of us, not just for the customers, not just for the well-to-do, not just for those people who are aesthetically pleasing to Pamela Comstock and Cynthia Matthews and other groups of that sort. Those are council members that have passed a series of ordinances that have that drastically reduced public space, already reduced, but reduced it even more in the fall of 2013. So that's going to be tomorrow at 9:30, Friday the 17th, in front of the Cafe Pergolisi, and you're invited to come and get a cup of coffee, bring a video camera of your own, bring some signs if you want about ending the criminalization of people in terms of everyone's right to use the sidewalk. Rich and poor, black and white, young and old, you name it. Walking upright or hobbling along on a cane or in a wheelchair, all folks have the right to use the sidewalk. And I would also say, you know, that people have the right to cluster on the sidewalk in groups, particularly if they have no other places to go. Police have kind of driven youth off of areas on the main Pacific Avenue sidewalk. And I say that speculatively as a sort of because I've seen very few youth in any groups on the sidewalk when I walk around. There are occasionally there are some people who listen to street musicians, but if they try to sit down next to a building or within 14 feet of anything, of course, unless you bring your own chair. That seems to be an exception. So you might consider bringing your own chair. At least that is my reading of the sitting ban ordinance in Santa Cruz. We're going to be there at the Perigo at 9:30. We invite you to come on down and bring documentation devices. It may be a very tame affair in the sense that what police have often done in the past wisely is simply avoid such protests. And then when there aren't cameras watching, when there aren't people with their eyes on what's going on, then they come back and they tell everybody they haven't got a right to stand on the sidewalk and loiter. They don't have a right to sit down. And here again, I want to clarify, it is illegal under city law to sit on almost any area in the downtown area on the sidewalk, which is ridiculous, of course, unless you're blocking it and refusing to move, or unless there's some other specific reason at the time. This massive ban on sitting is designed to severely restrict public assemblies of a certain kind, of a certain class of people, poor people, homeless people, young people. I would even say African-American people, insofar as there are groups of people that have been hanging out that meet all these descriptions and then get dispersed under these laws, and also, of course, the smoking laws and smoking bans that have become almost universal in business districts all over town. It's a seizure of public space, and this is an attempt to restore it. So, come on down, check it out, and I'll be there. We can all chat about these issues, too. And in the meantime, let's listen to a little music and maybe call in if we have some stories, accounts, concerns, or reactions to what I've been saying, what you've been hearing. Seem to be having a little problem with this machine. I'm not sure what the problem is, but I'm going to work on it and see if we can resolve it. So let's try machine number two.
I've always hated Blockbuster.
Target. McDonald's.
The Gap.
Pepsi.
Nike. IBM.
Starbucks. Not quite so much. If I'm not boycotting at least three oil companies, I start to feel out of touch. I wouldn't be seen in Nordstrom's or any such. And I hate Walmart. I don't like whips. I don't like chains. I don't go chopping up my neighbor's brains. Don't really like shopping except at the flea market. I hate Walmart. Now you may wonder, what's all this fuss? If you don't like the train, take the bus. Well, I found religion, and just between us, company sell the low cost, drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why I hate Walmart. Used to be you drive around, stop in on three or four towns, encounter different sights and sounds, different if not unique, different accents, different smells, different things to buy and sell. Now it's all Taco Bell. I hate Walmart. Slow, relax your mind. Never knew what you'd buy around the next bend. But now the freeway goes so straight, it go right past the pearly gate. I don't feel human, I feel like freight. I hate Walmart. I like to roam, I like to greet individuals on the street. You always know the one you meet is the one. cotton, Newt Gingrich. I walk out everything which I've seen advertised. I used to go out for dinner in a diner. Now they say fast food is finer, but it tastes like it fell out of an airliner. It's enough to make you weep. I don't like board games. I don't like brand names. They make inflated claims. They're full of bleep. Everyone I meet is a high-tech killer. That wants to sell me a digital potato peeler. And I don't like Garrison Keillor, cause he's so white. Turn on my radio dial. I like to hear something new once in a while, but it's the same old crap in a brand new style. It's audio rape. Still I try to pick and choose. I turn the dial, but always lose. They only play the words rock and roll, and once in a while, if you're lucky, maybe one little rhythm and blues. And that's why God made tape. Used to be we wore beads and bells, made our own clothes in our own way. Now we all wear uniforms at Hard Rock Cafe. We're in a state of sartorial decay, and that's why I hate Walmart. There's a pretty spot, they'll pave it over. Put a clover leaf over a four-leaf clover. Black paint on a white cliffs of Dover, it never fails. Hope you like this song. Thanks a bunch. Could go on, but I gotta go eat lunch. If you didn't like it, I've got a hunch. You work in sales. Your own, make your own. Be careful what you own. Develop non-shopping to an art. And whatever you do, don't shop at Walmart.
And that was an old one from Dave Lippmann, I Hate Walmart, from an album of the same name. Now you're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, freakradio.org on your computer screen. We are still in the studio, haven't been evicted yet. There may be some problems with that. Our main problem is the transmitter. We are about to lose our transmitter site. I know, it's wolf, wolf, wolf again. We're crying wolf, but we're not, really. It's just a very slow and uncertain process of when the banks will foreclose on the place that we have our antenna up at. And we need a place to put it and put our transmitter. It's not, doesn't take a lot of space. Anywhere in the downtown area where an antenna could be put up that'll be as high as, oh, I don't know, two-story house or a tree, it can be done. So if you have any ideas, you want to keep hearing this on your radio and even on your computer, the best thing to do is to get in touch with us and let us know. If you have any thoughts, suggestions, talk to your friends, see what they say. The number to call, you can leave a message at my phone, 423-HUFF, the HUFF line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And I will pass on the word to the folks at the Free Radio Santa Cruz Collective, and I'll be very grateful to hear about it. Otherwise, we will continue our search. Ever hopeful, but not apparently getting us where we want to get, which is a pity. So I'm going to play some audio. I say that now because it's no longer tape. It's audio. I kind of am in the 21st century finally. So I guess we'll start with this Food Not Bombs meal, which happens every Saturday and Sunday out at the main post office in downtown Santa Cruz. And that's a place to go if you want some tasty, free, vegan food. I'm actually not a big eater of the meal myself. I usually run around getting interviews or passing out flyers occasionally. So that's true. But others like it, and I would suggest you might too. I'm going to try to pick up where we left off at a prior show. I think we're interviewing a guy called Kip, who's an activist, who has talked about a secondhand report he received of someone being kicked in the face by, I believe it was a It's either police officer or security guard on being woken. But I don't have the actual account by the actual person. And Kip hasn't yet, although I think he's attempting to get it. Let's hear what at least part of that conversation, which we began on a prior show.
Yeah. Assaulting a shoe with one's mouth. I mean, what was he charged with, assault or resisting arrest?
Resisting arrest.
What was the underlying charge, or was there any?
I'm not sure. I guess he was woken up, so.
Perhaps he was sleeping illegally?
Yeah, perhaps.
Well, this has a sort of a familiar ring to it. That's what I noticed. I may have heard this happening, not so much the shoe to the mouth thing, although I've heard of people being kicked recently, at least one other account. But the waking seems to be something that happens regularly.
Yeah, and it can be traumatizing to people too, you know. People report like bad dreams of recurring nightmares of being woken by the police, you know, because
PTSD.
PTSD. Such a traumatizing event.
Have you been sleeping outside yourself, Kip?
Yeah.
Have you been experiencing this? Are you lucky or wise, or what's happening with you in sleeping outside? If you wish to say.
Well, I have accrued two tickets, but yeah, I suppose I don't sleep in, you know. I wake up early.
And what about your associate here? How about you? Have you been getting sleeping tickets?
Not recently. I'm an early bird, and I usually get out of the city, the inner city, and go a little bit away so I don't get bothered by too many people in general.
Even guys with machines that stick them in your face like this?
Yeah, something perhaps.
Is it fair to say that many or most of the citations come from people who are late risers, or do you think that's not accurate? What do you think?
You know, I'm not. I don't have any knowledge on what kind of prejudice law enforcement uses when it comes to waking people. There's like kind of a, it seems like a general rule, which is that there's, you know, different jurisdictions, and then there's patrols through those jurisdictions.
Well, what about reports from people who are getting the citations? In other words, do they report mostly getting them after 8 o'clock, or mostly before 7 o'clock, or a mix, or do you have any sense of that?
I think that it depends, you know. I think that 6:30 is a wake-up call by the police in some places, and that's a prime time to get a ticket. But
is that your wake-up time? When do you usually?
I'm up before 7, though.
You are.
Yeah.
But you don't, and yet you've only gotten two tickets in the course of how long?
My entire homeless life.
Which has been
couple of years.
So you are either very lucky, or perhaps the police are, you know, very wise in your fortuitous choice of spots, or possibly for some other reason. Perhaps not in Santa Cruz, but you haven't spent much time here.
Well, no, I haven't spent that much time here, but this is the only location where I have received tickets. And I think that that's due to the fact of not really being aware of sort of the race to the bottom that's occurring with the coast of California and them trying to kick homelessness between their different cities, you know. And so, like, becoming aware of that, I guess I had to kind of change my habits, and I haven't really gotten a ticket since then.
But the change in your habits has been not necessarily to get up before 6:30, but to get up before 7.
There are various places that you do that you don't sleep, and various places that you might be more capable of sleeping. I also I wouldn't suggest Well, yeah, I would not suggest camping. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like people who are disabled and can't necessarily leave downtown or go off the beaten path, you know, are kind of trapped and kind of stuck to deal with police downtown or deal with the shelter.
That would make an interesting study as to, you looked at the tickets and you researched the people, how many of them have disabilities compared to the general homeless population, those who are less specifically disabled and hence able, as you would suggest, at least under your theory, to avoid citations or avoid areas where they're more likely to get citations.
Yeah, I think, but I'm not sure on that. I think it'd be interesting to look into.
Any other thoughts you want to pass on?
Not
required, you know. It's okay.
Yeah, I think that's well, there was, no, I'm good right now. Yeah.
Thank you, Kip. Anything you want to say to conclude with?
No, I'm good for now.
And we've been talking with?
Bryce.
Thank you, Bryce.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Kip. Should be on the air maybe tomorrow. And we're here at the in front of Jamba Juice. There's a setup with a lot of amplified music. Hey. Whoa. All right. What's going on here?
Party.
It's a party?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now that you're here, it is.
Yeah, I have no objection. Did they make you get a permit for this? How much did it cost, you know?
It was $33.
Yeah, and how long in advance did you have to do it? I'm asking for free radio. That's what I'm doing here.
We did it, I would say, probably 4 weeks, something like that.
Maybe yeah, through the police department, I take it.
Yeah. Yeah, we got to go through the cops to get the sound permit.
And is this going to be a regular event? Are you going to be coming out and doing this?
Yeah, we do this about once a month. We try to do it on first Fridays, but sometimes we have other things going on. But usually we'll do it once a month, try it on first Fridays, but sometimes we'll do it on a Saturday.
And is there a group that... Are you individuals or part of a group?
We're a tag team called Chill Pill. And, you know, we play our own separate gigs, but when we get together, we're called Chill Pill. And we've been trying to get people out with some funk music on, you know, beautiful days downtown Santa Cruz. I feel like it's lacking a little bit of, you know, bringing the community. I mean, there's lots of community things that bring people together, but none that are focused around
non-shopping oriented.
Yes, non-shopping. Just come out, have a good time. Bring your kids. Bring your friends. Like, we shut down at 9, and then everybody goes home and or not.
How many folks showed up today?
We have about 30 people saying they're coming, and then we're hoping for another 20 to 30 people from just walking around in the streets.
So did you just set up, or are you...
Just set it up.
And we've been talking with...
My name is Drew.
And you are?
Carly Jeffries.
Hey, thank you very much, Carly and Drew. I'm Robert.
Robert.
So I'll give you a card. This should be on the air. Anything you want to add before I go?
Come see us first Fridays downtown. Chill Pill will be here in front of Jamba Juice having a funk dance party.
Whoa.
That's right. Be here.
Okay. And you can still hear the music going on as I cross the crosswalk to the post office. I guess it goes on for several hours into the evening, starting around 6. So the one question I didn't ask as a period of time, but it does have a boom-de-boom quality to it, doesn't it? Down here at the Food Network.
And, hey, more music and life downtown, the better. That's always good. Interesting, though, that the requirements to get an amplified sound permit, which can become the basis or the pretext for giving people expensive tickets, if they even have very small amplified sound devices that aren't really very loud, is an interesting one. You have to go through the police department to get a permit, and you must do so weeks in advance. So if you want to do something more quickly, it can be very difficult, or at least I don't have a lot of experience because I never apply for permits. I don't believe in it. I think there's such thing as free speech, and I get out there and I say what I need to say, and then I do what I need to do, and that's pretty much that. But to follow the rules that have been set down, sort of like the net rigging tripwire of rules of the downtown ordinances that tell you can't sit here, you can't sit there, your device has got to be inside this little bracketed area of a certain particular color for only a certain amount of time, even though there's no really requirement and any meaningful need for any of that other than to give a particular class and a particular authority power over the downtown sidewalks, at least power that insofar as people obey and are afraid of it. It has very little to do with what the realistic requirements of the interaction between pedestrians and merchants and street vendors and homeless folks downtown really is. That kind of creative interaction is not something that it's something that is now shoehorned into a prefabricated series of laws, which give those who make the laws and enforce the laws the power over the situation. So I'm going to spin another from Dave Lippmann. I'm actually, since it's not a record, I ain't really spinning it, but I'll play it, and maybe you'll like it.
Blockbuster.
Jordan and Ed Morgan were two good old boys from my hometown. They were good boys, not so old boys, you really couldn't say they'd been around. When it came to race, creed, color, gender orientation, and endangered species, you really couldn't say they'd made a scene. In fact, they were liable to scorch you to the edge of town for wearing the wrong color jeans. Then one night down at the bar, they chanced to meet a representative of some committee of the UN, who introduced them to a couple of her friends, took them on a trip around the world, and later on brought them back again. Roy Jordan and Ed Morgan moved in the two houses down the road, just to the left and right of mine, but I don't mind long as they keep it up to code. Roy Jordan and Ed Morgan had no sooner gotten out of bed than there were three blonde Muslims, two Peruvian PhDs, and funny ideas getting into their heads. Roy Jordan and Ed Morgan went down to the corner store. Roy Jordan and Ed Morgan really couldn't know what was in store, cause there was a Micronesian working on a macro program for a list of all the famous gays in history, when suddenly a spaceship came on by and took them to another planet where there was no corner store, and they really had to wonder why. Well, there was no corner cause there was no straight streets and no straight people, well, maybe just a few, and I guess you'd have to say they were treated rather well. Madonna and Nine Inch Nails and Ice-T and Wu-Tang and Jews and stuff and even Arabs too. And then Jesus came along and he was a Rubenesque black lesbian, and they really didn't know what to do. Roy Jordan and Ed Morgan were two good old boys from my hometown. They were good boys getting to be old boys. I guess you could say they were getting around. Then one night down at the bar, the chancellor met a man who was just this far short of being a mensch, who thought he knew whereof he spewed. So Roy said, boy, give it to mensch. So one night down at the bar, the chancellor met a man who's fit to be fenced. Tell him they'll marry to a gay black Jewish Puerto Rican, see if he can figure out which party's against.
And that was another one from Dave Lippmann's album, I Hate Walmart. That was called Roy Jordan and Ed Morgan. Again, these are songs from the 90s, so we're talking old tunes. But they got a beat to them, and they got some lyrics, and they got some political spazazz as well. So, coming up next Monday, this was brought up at our weekly Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa at 11 o'clock in the morning, 7:03 Pacific, for all you folks who don't know, might want to come, open to the public, free coffee. We decided some of us are going to at least show up at the Pacific, Public Safety Committee, which I tend to call the Public Prejudice Committee or the Public Bigotry Committee. They're a group that essentially is kind of a rubber stamp for the police and the fire department. Cynthia Chase, Councilmember Terrazas, and Councilmember Comstock are the three Santa Cruz City Council members who are on that committee. They'll be meeting on April 20th, Monday, at 6 o'clock at the City Hall. And if you're interested in this issue, you might want to check it out to be sure that we may be providing food there for folks to come on down and raise issues at this relatively small meeting. It's usually often held in the back room, but sometimes it's held in the main City Council chambers. There's a City Council chambers, which some of you listeners are aware of, across from the main library in the City Council complex. And then right behind the City Council chambers is a smaller room to which council members sometimes retreat and which also holds the committee meetings at times. And this is one of the few, I think there are three standing committees or so of the Santa Cruz City Council. Committees, you might think, might be the places where the public could actually sit down with members of the City Council and hammer out legislation, get their views really heard and talk with them about their issues in ways where there might be a kind of a more formal process of putting together laws that aren't just prefabricated and ready for the rubber stamp, as seems to be the case usually at the Santa Cruz City Council meetings. The Bearcat was a perfect example of that. And all the subsequent tarantara and trump-de-dump and public comment was all pretty meaningless, had little to do with any kind of meaningful reconsideration of the Bearcat. And the same process happens with a lot of different things. And so in Congress, committees are where issues are worked out. So, for example, the right to rest law, which I've been talking about a bit on the air. It's a state law that would throw out all the local city laws that criminalize homeless resting. Sitting, for example, it would not be possible to criminalize people who are sitting down in public spaces unless they're doing some crime. And it got a lot of flack from right-wing columnists. If you look at San Francisco Chronicle, you'll find critics of that. But it got a lot of support from, naturally, homeless activists like myself and others throughout the state. A group called RAP, Western Regional Advocacy Project, put in a lot of time organizing and getting actually a state senator, Senator Liu of Los Angeles, one of the suburbs down there, to introduce this right-to-rest law, and it went to committee. It got a number of, they lined up a number of votes, but they did not line up enough votes for them to want to risk a vote this month in the committee. So essentially they're going to allow it to die for the year, at which point it will be brought back next year, or at least that's what I'm reading in the emails. I guess if they went to a vote, perhaps it would mean that they couldn't bring it back, would be gone for the session. But it's too bad, although Sacramento is a sort of a difficult place to try to do that. I've always suggested it be done focusing on a city where everybody could sort of go to that city and demand that they restore rights for the homeless. We do have a caller. Yo, caller, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Uncle Robert. Great show. I love the putting the music in between the interviews and so forth. That's so great. Tomorrow morning, wake up, Santa Cruz. You know, fascism creeps in. And one of the ways it creeps in is by stealing public space. That's what the city government's gonna do, and they're using the police to do it, which guarantees fascism. So I'm telling everybody to wake up. Tomorrow we show up at that demonstration. I'm gonna be probably there by bus, and I'll probably be coming home by bus. No matter what, I'll be there.
Well, bus in, but don't get busted.
You know, I'm about ready. This is ridiculous. Okay, people, show up. Be there or be square.
Thank you, David.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that is the Cafe Pergolesi tomorrow, 9:30 in the morning, Friday morning, on April 20th, which is also, of course, 420 Day. There should be some traditional smoke-out mega ceremonies up at the university. And, of course, they usually block off the campus and so forth. But you can go to both. You can show up at 9:30 at the Pergolesi and support the right to rest, the right to assemble, the right to linger, the right to loiter in Santa Cruz, which is it's an important right, and it shouldn't be deterred by security thugs or cops or hosts or people who are in the businesses who think that somehow they prefer to, well, I feel they prefer to have not so many people lingering outside their store. Even though people still have access to this store, they just think it perhaps gives the wrong image. Well, image is in the eye or the mind of the watcher, and this is, as I said, these sidewalks are public sidewalks. They're all our sidewalks, and they have to be reclaimed by the public. So 9:30 tomorrow, come on down for some coffee. Come on down to discuss the issue, and I'll be there to join you. The Public Safety Committee meeting is at 6 o'clock on Monday evening at City Hall. It is a small group of people, three people, as I said before, Chase, Comstock, and Terrazas, who have forwarded a lot of anti-homeless laws to the City Council and have also been, they were sort of the fig leaf for the stay-away laws that were passed in January. Stay-away laws are the laws that allow the police officers on their own initiative, if they're giving an infraction ticket, which they can do for all kinds of things, if you're homeless, if you're in a park after dark or any of the areas, which, and most of them are closed after dark, I think one of the few areas that the Parks and Rec has authority over, which you may not know about, is Pacific Avenue. It doesn't close after dark, in theory. It's not illegal to walk on the sidewalk after dark or after 11 o'clock at night or at any time, 24 hours a day, which, of course, should be the case all over the city on any public property. It should be. But because, of course, there's a huge housing and job crisis, and there's also a huge amount of misappropriation of money to foreign wars and huge corporations and 1% profiteers, you have a situation where people are forced into homelessness. And then, of course, they're reclassified as either junkies, bums, alcoholics, or crazy people, which is a nice way of saying, see, these are all people who can only have themselves to blame, or let's say their own conditions make them this. It has nothing to do with the economy. It has nothing to do with the priorities of the society. It has nothing to do with what Santa Cruz is being turned into, a sort of ritzy, gated bedroom community for those who have money, who were born here but now can't afford to live here. And that, of course, that kind of mythology has become more and more prevalent, in not just this city, but in others. And other myths like, they'll all come to Santa Cruz if we allow them their rights. Well, we're going to have to demand our rights. No one's going to allow us rights in Santa Cruz unless we assert them. That's unfortunately the truth. And it may require some pain and suffering to get there to do it, or at least some persistence and some patience and some repetition. Going and asking the city council and standing in line on the side of the room at oral communication doesn't quite do the trick, either for stopping the militarization with the Bearcat armored personnel carrier or for allowing a homeless person a right to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere legally at night. These people are deaf to those things. And there's a reason why they're deaf. It's not because they're a weird, bizarre, deformed human souls, although it certainly may appear that way at times. And indeed, if you judge people by their actions, sometimes you come up with that conclusion. I've said before I think it is the machine they're in that creates this whole thing. And it's also the political interests that they feel they have to respond to, large business, real estate, and developer interests that they are simply pawns in the face of. And even the people who you might like the best, who say they're really trying to proceed to by increments, to proceed step by step, inch by inch, as yard by yard our rights are taken away, like Micah Posner, who's sometimes votes in the right way on city councils, and sometimes speaks up for some issues, but basically does not in the way that he could be in terms of speaking up and organizing people outside city council, the way, for example, the Berkeley city council members who are in the minority up there do, like Chris Worthington. He chooses not to do that. He does a little of it, mostly in a very quiet way, hence I call him Mouse Heart Micah. I don't know if his heart is mousy or if he's just decided that's the way to go. It's, you know, he has to wait for the proper moment, preserve the capital for the proper juncture. The trouble is the proper juncture never comes, and you become co-opted in the system. Now, there's an article in the Street Spirit about why criminalizing poverty sells in Berkeley. It was written by activist Carol Denny, who is a humorist and a singer. You've heard her songs. I've been playing some of them recently. I've got some of her CDs when I was up there protesting the anti-homeless laws that are being put before this Berkeley City Council. When they do that, when the Berkeley City Council considers such laws, they face a lot of opposition. The room was full of opponents, whereas including social service providers who are, you know, being offered bones and meat and little pieces and carrots, so to speak, to go along with the merchants' latest laws. And in Berkeley, those laws that are being proposed are a series of ordinances that will prevent panhandling within 10 feet of a parking pay station, require the placement of personal objects, prevent the placement of personal objects in planters, tree wells, or within 3 feet of a tree well. It's kind of like our ordinance, you can't sit on the concrete abutment around the trees on Pacific Avenue. There's absolutely no reason why that should be except to drive people away who are lower class people in the sense that they're poorer people or they're homeless people or they're younger people who aren't shopping but are using the area as a meeting place, which is as it should be, but just displeases those who want a certain monolithic quality to the downtown. Another ordinance preventing lying on planter walls or inside of planters. We actually have an ordinance that bans lying anywhere downtown on any public property in the downtown business district. It's a complete ban on lying down. That's why if you want to lie down, bring your car, if you have a car, or maybe your bike, if you have a bike, and lie down on top of your bike. I don't know how you can do that with an ordinary bike. Or the car is possible. I've done it on top of my vehicle. Another ordinance that's being considered, and I should say has already been passed, not in its final form, but as a directive to the city manager to come forward with it up in Berkeley, prevents, quote, deployment of bedding, tenting, sleeping pads, mattresses, blankets, etc. on sidewalks and plazas from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Now, if you compare this with Santa Cruz, you have a blanket and bedding ban after 11 o'clock at night until 8:30 in the morning, a nighttime bedding ban, but it's completely citywide. This ban is only with regard to commercial areas in Berkeley. But down here, there is a citywide ban on bedding at night. I mean, that's completely absurd. I mean, the Berkeley law makes some kind of twisted sense. It says, well, we don't want you sleeping during the day in front of the stores because people will get the wrong idea. They'll think that we're a heartless, lack of compassionate community that only simply wants to keep selling people as you, and you have to, you know, we don't care if you have to walk over bodies, come and buy our schlock. And that we don't like that. Get that stuff out of here so that people don't see it. Hide somewhere else, please. In Santa Cruz, you're not allowed to put a blanket on the sidewalk anymore unless it's elevated, you see. We have a very high opinion of ourselves, or at least they want to elevate the tone of the downtown. And that is 24 hours a day. And you can't put a blanket out at all at night anywhere in town, as I said before. That's called laying down bedding. That's a violation of 6.36010B of the camping ordinance. The ordinances in Berkeley that I'm reading are actually milder than those proposed in Santa Cruz, yet they're being fought more vigorously because it's the sort of the diseased nose of the camel in the tent. You let this in, and then what comes next? And this is what's happened in Santa Cruz. Originally, the sitting ban was a 6-foot setback from buildings. You couldn't sit within 6 feet of a building. Then it was increased to 10 feet. Actually, I think it was increased to 14 feet, but musicians and political tablers could be within, if they were 10 feet away from building. Then that was increased to 14 feet. And in essence, you have no space except the very specific spaces, the little boxes, the little cages, the little bracketed areas on the sidewalk that the city council, in its wisdom, has declared are the only legitimate places for you to be able to use your public sidewalk. Continuing with the Berkeley ordinances, another ordinance has been forwarded preventing personal items from being affixed to public fixtures, including poles, bike racks, planters, trees, tree guards, newspaper racks, parking meters, and pay stations. This has to do, I guess, with dogs, but also political signs, I would say. And there's an ordinance preventing unpermitted cooking on public sidewalks. So, I don't know if Santa Cruz did such a thing, they would use this to go after Food Not Bombs. It doesn't really cook on the sidewalk. I think at the meeting in Berkeley where this came up, there was a woman specifically who they targeted, who claimed that she was being targeted because she provides food for other people, and she felt they were trying to criminalize what she was doing. And these are the ordinances, and there says a few other recommendations or actually directives that are being given to the city manager to come back and present final laws up in Berkeley that were passed over the objections of almost the entire Berkeley public audience. And a late night went on for hours and hours. It's quite something to listen to if you go on to the online to hear it. I was going to play some of it, but it kind of got past me. Other more local stuff interested me. Here's what Carol Denny writes about why criminalizing poverty sells in Berkeley. And this is in the current issue of Street Spirit, which there aren't too many of them around, but I'm going to make sure that at least that one is going to be in the library, and some may be available tomorrow at 9:30 at the in front of the Cafe Pergolesi if you want to come down and restore public space in front of the cafe there. Why criminalizing poverty sells in Berkeley. Criminalizing homelessness, Denny writes, is the most expensive, least effective way to address homelessness. Studies prove it, reporters note it, and common sense suggests it, since paying for a year of low-income housing or even a college education costs a lot less than a year in jail. So why does it sell like crazy? From coast to coast, we're bristling with new anti-homeless and vagrancy laws. According to No Safe Place, the criminalization of homelessness in U.S. cities, a report by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. You can find that online, No Safe Place. California leads the way with an average of 9 anti-homeless laws per city, according to the UC Berkeley School of Law Policy Advocacy Clinic and their new study, California's New Vagrancy Laws. These laws typically criminalize standing, sitting, lying down, sleeping, having belongings which might be used for camping, sleeping in your own car, sharing food with others, and asking for money. Many of these actions are unavoidable for people who have no place to go. Why are these embarrassingly heartless laws so easy to pass and so popular? The answer is that there is currently a political cost to any politician who insists on the creation of low-cost housing as a priority. But there is very little political cost at present to passing yet another law, even an unconstitutional law, which burdens the poor or persecutes the homeless. Berkeley is a great case in point. Berkeley is a college town, notoriously liberal. This may sound familiar to you folks in Santa Cruz. Consistently cast as comically out of touch with mainstream American politics by the national press. But mayor after mayor in Berkeley has been more than willing to override the will of the community, ignore the moral objections of religious and human rights groups, and go to bat in court for unconstitutional legislation on behalf of political groups who want the poor to just disappear. In an interview early in his political career posted online by Berkeley author and poet John Curl, Mayor Tom Bates of Berkeley referred to rent control as a no-win position for him and a death knell for politicians generally. Berkeley citizens, in the absence of honest leadership on the issue of low-income and affordable housing, cite their own frustration with panhandling and homelessness as reason enough to vote repeatedly for laws of dubious constitutionality which target poor people on the street struggling with unemployment, evictions, and skyrocketing rents. U.S. District Judge Claudia Wilkin issued a temporary restraining order in 1995 against Berkeley's 1994 anti-panhandling law, noting that some Berkeley citizens feel annoyed or guilty when faced with an indigent beggar. Feelings of annoyance or guilt, however, cannot outweigh the exercise of First Amendment rights. That's Claudia Wilkin's statement 20 years ago. Poor and homeless people are notoriously ill-equipped to hire lawyers and mount legal challenges to the anti-poor laws generated primarily by merchant associations, which in the case of the powerful Downtown Berkeley Association, or in Santa Cruz, the Downtown Association, get mandated membership payments from all the businesses within its expanding downtown footprint. That's also true in Santa Cruz. The DBA's board is dominated by large property owners who were the primary funders of the failed anti-sitting law campaign in Berkeley's 2012 election. There is not a single representative on the board from the poorly funded nonprofits and law clinics who work with the poor and homeless people caught up in the endless web of criminalization of poverty. Those are the groups who will show up in opposition to the new anti-homeless initiatives, but they are much less likely than wealthy investment and property companies to be able to toss large campaign donations to council members running in the next election. The Berkeley City Council knows that circling poor and homeless people endlessly through overburdened courts and jails over unpayable fines for innocuous offenses is dumb. They tend to be intelligent people who by now have had somebody toss a copy of the report on California's new vagrancy laws by the UC Berkeley Policy Advocacy Clinic or the No Safe Place report on the criminalization of homelessness in U.S. cities from the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, or both, on their desks. They may have even read the reports. But it takes courage to say no to merchant associations and the University of California's short-sighted effort to make homelessness and poverty invisible. Courage is in short supply in the Berkeley City Council chambers. For all the opining in January and February 2015 about the Black Lives Matter campaign, and even though the majority of those affected are people of color and people struggling with disabilities, the anti-homeless laws proposed by Berkeley City Council member Linda Mayo at the council meeting on March 17th passed with a predictable majority, proving that Berkeley's war on the poor will go on without interruption. Courageous testimony at the City Council by homeless people, UC professors and students, and advocacy groups seemed to make little difference to the council members who supported the proposal. The majority of the proposal's few citizen supporters were real estate brokers who complained about behavior which is already illegal, as council member Chris Worthington noted in his eloquent statement about the expense and ineffectuality of criminalizing more and more attributes of homelessness, such as deploying a blanket between 7 a.m. and 10 p.m., rather than addressing practical solutions. How many people have gotten clean and sober when there are consequences to their behavior? Asked Councilmember Lori Drost, proving you can put a new face on the council and raise the collective IQ not one iota. In other words, if you criminalize people, it'll help them get clean and sober. Councilmember Jesse Arguin removed his name as a sponsor of the anti-homeless laws, but offered the usual leavening of services in an ineffectual effort to balance the legislation, which, with all due respect to charities and humanitarian services, is a strategy consistently used in Berkeley to make it easier to pass repressive human rights violations, i.e., throw in a few social service carrots along with the sticks you're giving the police to beat the homeless out of town. And beat is actually in Berkeley, if you looked at the recent videos, well, videos from last month, about the hosts up there that call themselves ambassadors, of sort of parapolice, tourist, outfitted security squads that walk the streets. We have our own yellow jackets down here, the hosts. But they were, you know, caught on video kicking and beating two homeless guys, and then getting them falsely arrested. And that We've had, I don't have an instance of a host kicking or beating a homeless person in Santa Cruz, but I have many instances of hosts, I think, harassing people and moving them along in ways that are completely unnecessary, but that are indeed a part of their job. Which doesn't in any way justify what they do. And it shouldn't in any way prevent people from standing up and saying, stop doing that. Don't do that. Stop harassing people on my streets, on our sidewalks, on this in this community, the way you're doing. And indeed, that's what tomorrow we're going to be raising, at least trying to restore an understanding of the rights people have downtown, at least in front of the Cafe Pergolesi, which is just one place. This kind of stuff goes on all over town. No doubt it'll move somewhere else, or the police will come back another day. It's in no way any kind of a complete solution, but, well, not even a complete solution. It's an attempt to raise awareness there as to what's cooking. I did get a testimonial to the Cafe Pergolesi from a Huff member who I think I want to read aloud because I think it's a positive statement about the Pergolesi, because this is not primarily designed to criticize or boycott the Cafe Pergolesi, this protest. Although in the past, when we've noticed different businesses throwing people out because they have backpacks or telling people we have a policy of no backpacks, we launched a anti-backpack bigotry campaign. And Pergolesi was initially one of the targets of that. But they became clear that if they had done that before, they weren't doing it with consistency, and there seemed to be a change in their policy, as well as that of certain other businesses downtown, although now the backpack bigotry seems to be resurfacing, and that's going to be another issue perhaps for us among the many that come up. Here's what Boulder Creek Steve writes about the Cafe Pergolesi protest. I can't speak much for what is going on there now or much of this year, even. I haven't been to downtown Santa Cruz much this year, but I will speak highly of the Cafe Pergolesi from my years of homelessness. In addition to days when I did have the money to buy a brew, there were many, many days I just hung out both inside and outside for hours and never was bothered by employees or students. When homeless, I often was saved from the pouring rain by sitting inside. Some could say this was because I didn't look homeless, which I mostly did not. I often hid my homelessness by leaving my stuff outside on the porch, and since I had a hidden camp and tent in the woods, I didn't have to carry much. But there were times when I did have a full pack, looked as I was, homeless, and still had no problems inside. And for years, and probably still today, can't say for sure, there's a fellow who is indeed homeless. Looks the part, for he carries all his stuff with him. Anyway, every day he is in the Cafe Pergolesi inside, and he stays there from about 9 a.m. all day till about 5 p.m. He keeps his eyes mostly on his laptop screen, occasionally goes out for a smoke, but really he's in there all day. I never saw him buy anything, but he does carry a coffee mug to look the part of a customer. I never saw a cafe employee ask him to leave or even approach him. There is no other business or public space, even in Santa Cruz, that I felt okay to be at when homeless, as I did at the cafe. They were cool. So as far as the current issues mentioned about the planned activity for tomorrow, the sidewalk cafe, the Cafe Huff on the sidewalk at the Pergolesi, my theory is it is the neighbors of the Cafe Pergolesi that are causing the problem. Just like last week when passing by the cafe, I noticed that the apartment building to the right, if you're facing the cafe, has a no loitering sign that say the police will definitely be called. They don't own the sidewalk, but that area sure was nice when hauling heavy gear after a long hike to stop for a moment, have a sip of water, rest one's weary bones. But no, that is a crime, according to many, and now one cannot stop there even for a moment. Also, that same day last week, I was walking my bike along the sidewalk in front of the cafe as it turned the corner elm. There was indeed a group of teens, just plain young folks, chatting, smiling, enjoying the day. I admit at first I felt they were blocking the sidewalk, but I quickly dismissed that and simply walked around them, and they did not bother me at all. But I can see how other folks don't like it that some people are gathered, chatting, enjoying themselves in the day. They probably would rather see those people inside the mission being forced to read the Bible and listen to hellfire sermons in order to get a meal. Well, not sure if I can get downtown for tomorrow's action, but I did want to make a statement from my years of homelessness and experiences at the Cafe Perg that they were cool. Perhaps they've changed, but if so, I venture to say it was forced on them. That's Boulder Creek Steve. Thanks, Steve, for sending that in. Well, let's go to Dave Lippman again and hear one of his online MP3s. Assuming I can actually get this thing to work. There we go. He has a lot of his music that's now available free, and I think that's cool.
Job last week for healthcare. I was up the creek. Oh, I don't want to be that number. That's why I will not be meek. When working folk must get food stamps or live like 1930s tramps. Well, I don't want to be in that number when working folks must get food stamps. Yes, we are here, like Paul Revere, to warn you of what's going down. No, I don't want to be in that number when our country's going down. When we stand up for our fair share, when we stand up for our fair share, when I want to be in a number, when we stand up for our fair share, when we stand up and when we shout, respect is what is all about.
On Pacific Avenue, it's about 7, in front of Forever 21 with the Wire Tree Woman. What's your name, madam?
Francisca.
And Francisca, you've been down here for how long today?
15 years.
15 years at the same spot, eh? You're growing roots here with the wire
the
roots.
The tree roots,
but
yeah.
Today, how long have you been here?
Since 2 o'clock.
No hassles?
And I haven't been in this spot since 2 o'clock. I'm moving.
You move when asked, or you're just moving before you're asked?
I make a personal choice to move.
Because you enjoy the thrill of moving from spot to spot.
I enjoy letting other people have the best spots.
Well, it doesn't look like there are many other people now. Was there a big turnout today?
Yes.
And what was the most notable event of the day that you noticed?
I heard that they had a sort of a foster child support festival today, and I think that was pretty cool that they were doing that.
Okay. Anything visual that you wish to describe for our poor radio audience that can't see anything?
Another day in paradise.
Well, there you have it. No tickets? Nothing of that kind?
No.
And no problems for the last few weeks?
Well, you know what I do is, unlike some other people out here, I like to park in the back lots for 50 cents an hour. And that way, you never get a ticket on the street. Because you always pay for how long you're going to be there.
You're talking about parking tickets.
Yes, sir. What kind of tickets are you talking about?
Your display device tickets, like this illegal blankie you have on the sidewalk. It's outside the red zone. You probably don't have a license for these two children.
I do have a license.
You do?
I mean, I am licensed, yes.
You have papers you can show.
Yes, sir. certifications and
all right, we'll let that
pedigrees.
Are they trained? I mean, are they total trained?
They are, yes, yes.
Right, I mean, all right, well, we'll take that into consideration. Okay, well, thank you. And if you want to, are you going to be down here for the next few days? If we
indeed,
want to check.
Indeed, indeed, Norris. I sell my wire trees out here on the weekends after 2 o'clock.
What could be clearer? We've been talking to
CJ.
Thank you, CJ.
Nice to see you, Norris. Thanks for keeping the news real. Blessings.
All right. All right, well, I'm here at the 420 Art Stand, which is a table with many ink drawings. How would you describe your work, sir?
Psychedelic and funky art.
And I haven't seen you much on the avenue. Are you a newcomer here?
I am. I'm from the East Bay. I've been out here for about 4 years, but doing my art for about 2 months now.
And how is Pacific Avenue treating you?
So far, they're treating me well. They didn't at first, but I got a permit. And after I got the permit, I've been able to tell them to fuck off, and they leave me alone.
So give me kind of the before and after story. How were you doing it before? What happened? And then what happened?
So I was set up on the ground, and they gave me a $120 ticket, the cops did, and after that I researched it, found out that you're not actually supposed to be down here without a permit, so I went through, and it's only $35 to go get it, so they stay off your back, and that's for a year. So it's worth it, and ever since then, they've told me I need to move every hour. I don't do that. They tell me, you know, there's certain regulations that they have most people go by, but when I whip out my permit and I say, hey, if no one else is moving and I have a permit, then screw you. You know, you tell them to move first, and then I'll move. But until then, it's not happening. And I'm going to set up where I want. You're supposed to be, as an artist, I'm supposed to be in the little blue squares. I'm in a yellow, so this is actually performing.
You're just a criminal of all kinds of different colors.
Exactly. Here. And it's not even criminal, because I'm just trying to make a living down here.
It's interesting to hear this guy's account. Because it tends to show, if he's accurate in what he's saying, and he may well be, he sounds pretty specific about it, he's saying that, you know, there seems to be this, I haven't heard this from anybody else yet, though, that maybe one or two other people, that they went to get permits. You don't need a permit to set up a non-commercial display. And you don't need a permit to sell your art. Because that's considered a non-commercial display. Even if you're selling it, it's not considered commercial. You don't even need to give it away for donation. You're going to hear him say, I think in a moment, that the police required him to give it away only for donation. That's not, as my understanding, the case in White versus City of Sparks that former city attorney John Barisoni promised, committed himself to following when... Rights Seeker Robin, as I call the white-haired artist who was setting up his own artwork on Pacific Avenue, insisted that he would do. And they, it looks like the city is making these private deals with people, maybe. For instance, Punchback Pat Colby, a Huff activist who's done a lot of work on recycling to restore the recycling centers to general community use, not to mention homeless use, and also to defend the rights of people of color to be downtown, not to be selectively targeted by officers like Bradley Barnett, who seem to be doing so at a rather expanded rate. But she also has pointed out that people with disabilities need to have special dispensations, and she has requested repeatedly a dispensation for herself, since she's disabled, to set up a table and stay there at her table. And she's told that they will only do it on a sort of a hush-hush, voice-only agreement, not give her anything in writing. So what that means, of course, is there's no paper trail, there's no guarantee. She did make that request, I think, at public at City Council, and I suppose she can go back to the video of that. But it's not really very reassuring for people with disabilities who are trying to use the public spaces downtown. Anyway, are the police now sort of, you know, engaging in a little, or, you know, furthering the city's extortion racket of requiring money from people to get a little permit to be there as a way of I don't know, keeping track of who's downtown or making it, providing a cost to those who are downtown. I don't know. I mean, this is, it could be simply an individual case, or it could be an indication of a trend. But it's also interesting, you know, it does embolden this guy to say, you know, oh, you have to move every hour, not unless you make everybody else move every hour. I'm not going to move every hour. And, of course, if the police had to do that, make everybody move every hour, it would be quite a burden for them. So they only do so selectively, which, of course, is unequal protection of the laws, not to mention the laws themselves being abusive. And so he's found a way, if his account is correct, to at least kind of for the moment etch out a spot for himself. Hopefully that will continue, although, again, I'm always wary when individuals get some sort of special privilege. We all should have privileges. We all should have rights. We don't need privileges. And I had this problem with Morgani, the accordionist, who, whenever he was downtown, he'd violate the downtown ordinances like it was going out of style. But because he was such a fashionable, fancy-looking, upscale performer, they never bothered him. And my response was to chalk on the sidewalk in front of him, this display device is illegal, which upset him because he didn't want attention drawn to his special privileges. And then when the police went after him in the fall of 2013, because a rookie cop said, hey, you're violating the law. You know, he apparently hadn't heard the news that Morgani was one of these special people. Morgani just said, I won't come back. And indeed, he has only come back, I guess, to a private space. And not very often. I haven't seen him down there ever in the last 6 or 8 months. He may have been down there in front of the Rittenhouse Mausoleum, as I call the huge empty building that sits on the corner, sort of near the Cinema 9 Theater. Let's hear some more.
And like I was saying, I shouldn't be in the yellow, but because I have a permit, if they tell me
and
I shouldn't.
Your chair is at least 3 inches outside
of
the
yellow. And
indeed.
So I'm breaking all these laws. And really, if you have a permit, you can tell them to fuck off.
Well,
they'll leave you alone.
Well, that sounds good. Although I would advise my audience that even then you've got to be careful. But if you've been successful, I commend you and I wish you luck with that. In theory, if you're selling your artwork, you don't need a permit to engage in First Amendment activity. But if you got one, use it, I guess.
According to them. Yeah, exactly. According to them, if you're vending more than 6 days a year and you're not asking donations, so I would have to say whatever you want to give me for this piece, even though I want to sell it for a couple hundred as an original, I have to take donations.
That's the line that's occasionally used, but I mean, I've been around for 30 years. I've been familiar with people they tried that with. The person said, good, arrest me, and then sued them and got $5,000, actually $15,000. He was selling his CDs.
Oh, okay.
And let me get that straight. He was doing CDs for donation and they arrested him, but the next person I'm talking to wanted to sell his artwork, and he went and looked up a case called City of Sparks versus White, which is a federal case about 6 or 7 years ago, which essentially says you can't demand permits for selling artwork or expressive stuff. Now, the city attorney then, according to our friend whose name is Robin, who went to the city attorney and said, here's the case. I prefer not to go to court. Let's see. City attorney at that time, his name was John Barrisoni, said, okay, you know, then you can go sell your artwork. And I tried to get the attorney to publicly state this, the city attorney, and it was, he keeps a closed mouth about it, but he didn't deny it. And so, but continue with your good work. Do you remember which police officer advised you that you needed to get a permit to sell artwork?
I do not remember his name or his badge number, I'm sorry.
Fair enough. Well, hang in there, and we've been talking with
John Gutierrez.
And John, can we find your artwork online?
Yes, you can look me up on Facebook at John Gutierrez. That's and I also do mushroom photography.
And sell that. Spell that for me. Don't sell it. Spell it.
J-O-N G-O-U-T-I-E-R-E-Z.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
All right, man.
Appreciate it.
All right.
enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
So is this an online thing?
So we're talking with
Terrence Robinson.
And Terrence, we run into each other, or you've seen me at the Red Church, and you've had some thoughts today you wanted to speak about?
Actually, yes. I don't know, I'm going to actually just direct it more towards you.
Oh, sure, that's fine.
It sometimes bothers me because I hear a lot of people out here complain about the cops and the laws, and we can't do this, we can't do that. And it drives me absolutely nuts because I think people should be grateful, and they should be lucky that they even have a place to do what they're doing. Because you go to a lot of other cities, you go to a lot of other towns, they don't let you do that stuff. And all I hear people is just complain.
Well, I'm certainly one of the complainers.
Well, I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I understand people should be able to do what they want, but it just drives me nuts. I always hear so many complaints and so many people, like, bitching, like I said, about police. I've never had any problems with them.
That's good.
I haven't had any run-ins. And I don't know, I think a lot of the times why people get hassled by the cops, not saying that the cops don't just
mess up occasionally.
Yeah, that they fuck up occasionally. But a lot of times it's the people and what they're doing. And then it's the way, like, when the cops go up to them and they ask them a simple thing, hey, could you just move or could you just do this? Then they get lippy, they get cocky, and they say a lot of other stuff, and it kind of, like, ticks the cops off. And I don't know, it's... A lot of it comes by the way that people carry themselves, too. And I don't know, I just get frustrated about hearing about the laws and everything like that. People should be grateful about what they have instead of complaining all the time.
Well, that's certainly, you know, a point of view that I don't hear as much as I might, because I have an opposite point of view. And I'm glad that you're able to express it, you know. And we'll be playing it tomorrow morning on Free Radio.
Hey, sounds good. Thank you.
And we've been talking with...
Terrence.
Thanks, Terrence. Here, I'll give you a card. You can see what the deal is.
I actually had a cop. We were camping.
And Terrence also advised us that he had slept on the beaches for, I think, a couple of years, he said. And the one time he was approached by police, they gave him helpful information on where to go and times to get up and how to avoid certain shifts. And he was very impressed with that. And he was, well, you heard his perspective generally. I told him... I gave him the usual rap about how homeless people have no place to sleep, 95% of them. They're tired of carrying their shit around all day. They're tired of getting hassled by authorities right and left and trying to be nice to people that wake them up very early in the morning, even if they don't give them a ticket, is something you wouldn't expect from a middle-class person. As for someone who's been harassed at different points, perhaps in the last week, you might even expect it even less. On Pacific Avenue, and I'm talking about 215 with a woman whose bundles are outside the blue zone. Shocking, shocking. You're in front of Mission Hill Creamery. What's your name?
Serena Thompson.
And Serena, you have your sign, homeless, please help, thank you. But you were reminding me of an incident that happened with your boyfriend at one point.
Yes.
In City Hall.
One time he was sick, and then he needed to sleep, and he was laying on the...
One of the benches?
Not a bench, but on the...
some area, some concrete area?
Concrete area. Mm-hmm. And then John comes up and
Big
says...
Big John, the security
John,
guard?
Yes. Yeah. He said that you can't lay down. You gotta go. And then so my boyfriend just got up and then left.
And how long ago was this?
3 or 4 days ago.
You see, there is an ordinance used by police actually for decades, even before the current downtown ordinances were passed initially in 1994, called Conduct on Public Property. And if you walk by City Hall, there's a sort of a low-lying concrete fence, sort of, you call it a fence, along Church Street, right on the other side of the street from the Civic Auditorium, bordering the City Hall lawn, where people sometimes lie down. And it can be argued, and no doubt is, by Big John and others, that that's illegal because it's inappropriate conduct on public property, though, of course, it isn't. It's done traditionally. And it may even be a claim that the stuff was designed for that purpose. But a lot of it is in the manner and the actual intention of the security guard. If the security guard came up and said to him, if Big John had said to this woman's boyfriend, you know, it's illegal, or it might be considered illegal for you to lie on that area, but you can lie over there on the grass if you want, and that's legal. That would be one thing. Whereas if he said, get going and get out of here, that's illegal. That's a little something different. It shows a wholly different mindset. We have a caller, of all things. Let's see what the caller has to say. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi, this is Pat Colby.
Hey there, Pat.
Yeah, I heard that my ears were burning.
About what?
About my name being mentioned.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, we drop names every now and then. Don Lane, Pat
yeah,
Colby.
Yeah, David called me and thanked me. I really appreciate, you know, everybody appreciating what I do.
Oh, you do a lot. I mean, you are one of the main food coffee providers. You know, you do the Cafe Huff pretty regularly, and I think people do appreciate it.
Yeah, and I think that it's starting to get some more involvement from the people that we want to help.
Uh-huh.
So that's good. So I can have one little update on the recycling.
So, remind us of what this is, the recycling controversy, for those who don't know.
So I'm already on the radio. Okay, what it is there was no access that was compliant with state law to recycle, to get back your deposit in Santa Cruz at all, the whole city of Santa Cruz, which included Live Oak, because it's county. You had to go to Capitola, and if you were lucky, you could not go on the Wednesday and Thursday when the 41st recycling was closed. Then you had to go to Knob Hill or Aptos to recycle, which was not a breach of the regulations, because recycling set up in convenience zones. You're not supposed to have to spend so much in gas to get to recycle to get your money back.
You know, let me say something about that, Pat. In fact, this happened some months after groups of people came to the Transportation Commission, the commission, complaining about homeless people stealing bikes from their yard or aluminum and then recycling or hanging out in their neighborhood and taking their recycled materials and then go recycling it in this dubious recycling center which was keeping bad records. And there was an attempt, it seemed a pretty clear focus on the homeless folks, to deprive them of a source of income. That was my impression when I attended this meeting, which Rochelle Naroyan, now a council member, was chair of that commission. Then this shutdown of the recycling centers happened all over the city, or I guess there were only two of them, right? Two main recycling centers.
There was two, and there was two political motivations behind it that were pretty vocal. One was the thing that you mentioned, the complaint, because there's a unrealistic, irrational perception that the only people that do recycle plastics and cans for money are homeless people, which is not true. There's a lot of poor people that are elderly on fixed incomes, where if they don't get this $25 a month, they can't pay their rent or they can't buy food. And then I also noticed when I did go all the way to the different recyclings to take a friend to recycle because he needed that $25 to pay his rent, that there were soccer moms there. There was all levels of socioeconomic class. And they were all frustrated with the recycling problem. And unfortunately, at that time when I went, it took me 4 hours to get back $2 and some odd cents. And I was waiting in the sun for so long, I had to spend like $6 on drinks, also because I'm diabetic and I can't go without protein that long.
So, Pat, it seems
that money.
You were successful in then going to the state, you know, commissioner on this issue.
Oh, yes.
And in being successful, you've actually gotten some of these centers to either reopen or state they're going to reopen, and then also certain stores to either start accepting recycled stuff or have to pay some kind of a fine. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. So let me give you just a brief little update.
Go ahead.
So the city was forced to allow the Replanet Recycling Center at Costco to reopen in its original location while they get the architectural plans and everything to rebuild the building. So they were forced to reopen that plant that they had shut down. And when I went to get the public records on the west side, they claimed that the west side closed down itself, that there was no neighbors complaining, there was no other records, even though I have Rochelle Narayan during a tenant forum saying about it was a homeless issue, why it was shut down, and then also when they steal out of the blue recycling cans, they're stealing money from the city, and that's part of the city's budget. So I do have that on video, and then I also saw the Sentinel article, which refers to the information you shared. So it sounds like and that's part of the two political reasons. One is the city wants your money, which I knew was going to happen when they set up this deposit. Who's going to take the money of the unclaimed deposits? And so the city uses it as their budget, even though they claim they just use it for the recycling. And then there's all this anti-homeless propaganda that's going out. And the Costco one was shut down because it's so close to the, well, we call it the homeless lack of services, but it's the homeless service center. They said all these bums were coming there. They put all these restrictions on the Costco one to shut it down and not let them reopen originally. Like, they had to have a security or a security guard there all night. They had to be clean. There couldn't be any trash. They had to have cameras. But all these restrictions that other recycling centers aren't expected in other cities that California doesn't require. So they were forced to reopen the Costco one from the pressure of going to Sacramento and making complaints. And actually, citizens themselves helped this process, because I started handing out flyers, and you printed out my flyers and handed them out to tell people if they had any problems with recycling whatsoever, they're to call 1-800-RECYCLE. And so thanks to numerous of people, you know, standing up and complaining about it, Costco was forced to reopen.
Fair enough, yeah, Pat. Yeah. I'm going to have to end it there because we are running out of time. I'll give you the last word, but I'm going to roll on.
The problem still isn't solved, though. I'll have an update. I'm getting emails by the end of the week from the woman in Sacramento.
Okay, we'll be seeing you tomorrow at 9.
Sunday, maybe.
We'll be seeing you tomorrow at 9:30 with coffee and who knows what else.
To protest Pergolesi, thinking that they own the public sidewalk in front of their establishment.
Well, at least the police who are advising people they have to move on, whoever's directing them to do that, or even if they're doing it on their own accord.
Yeah, they're misinforming people that they don't have a right to hang out there when they do.
And I'm hoping that, you know, we can get some kind of flyer out. I know I was going to send you some text, which I haven't done. I will probably try to do that later this evening. But if you come up with something yourself and you want to put it out, do it.
Right. And one thing I did want to put out to your listeners is I'm hearing reports that are really disturbing of officers kicking homeless people in the head to wake them up and then citing them for sleeping at night during the hours they're not allowed to sleep, and throwing rocks at them, and also taking batons to their tents and hitting them, so they're assaulting them through their tents. And I really would like people to pass them on to you or pass them on to me, because I'm going to bring this up to the Right to Rest state legislators.
Okay, and I know that Micah Posner, council member, has a meeting time at 11 o'clock on Friday mornings for those who are interested in, maybe we should lead a march over to Micah's office from the Cafe Pergolesi to talk about these issues, or, you know, as he nods at us blankly or agrees with us or pats us on the back.
He does want to get the Right to Rest.
In any case, if you
Santa Cruz to be a city.
If you want,
I just want to say,
hang on a second, Pat. If you want to be a part of this, if you want to get in touch with Micah, you have to call him in advance, 420-5020, in order to make an appointment. If you want to, we've got complaints about this stuff, the kind of thing that Pat is mentioning, about, you know, rocks being thrown at people to wake them up, harassment by security guards, recycling problems. I got to go, Pat. We got to end it there. So I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Tomorrow for positive loitering at Pergolesi. Well,
to coin a term. Thank you. I just want to end the show by letting people know, you may have seen the story in the Sentinel, which features my beautiful portrait on the front page. Santa Cruz Nazi Salute civil rights case winds down after 13 years. This is a really kind of a post-mortem, which didn't really cover, unfortunately, what I hoped it would. I put a comment, I believe, in And all the comments have been removed on this story. Most of them were, you know, that Norris, that asshole, that's, you know, personal attacks on me. But the reality of the situation is that I still believe, although there are those who disagree with me, and apparently if they disagree with me, they don't disagree enough to have me arrested, that if you are at city council and you engage in First Amendment activity, provided you are not disrupting the council meeting, they can make 151 rules against what you do, but it is still constitutionally protected. So, for instance, this controversy, which I brought up repeatedly on the air about my recording device, which I place traditionally on the banister near the speaker's podium, which has been necessary in the earlier months of this year, and I still do it with some regularity, and often I have to beat Sergeant Bush there, who tries to remove it, because that's what he's told to do by the city council mayor, Don Lane, that you have a right to do this, even if they create a rule that says it's a decorum that you can't do this and you can't do that, unless it creates an actual disruption. A decorum rule is not necessarily operative on you if you choose to ignore it. Now, that is an issue I'm going to be bringing up for discussion in future shows, and it's important in a certain way, because if people do want to go to city council, and I don't necessarily advise people to go to city council, even though some think it's a great democratic process and how else can you do it, one can see that, for example, going to city council in numbers, as the Bearcat people did, had absolutely... I don't want to say absolutely no impact. It had obviously had an impact, but not on the council majority. All they're doing is they have essentially